now in South Africa at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and I'd like to thank the organizers for having me here. It's been a lot of fun. And so I'm going to talk sort of about a hodgepodge of things. We've been involved, are heavily involved in several different non-SKA cosmology projects. I think Brian is going to cover the SKA side of things later on today. So I'll talk about these. I'm going to focus on three, two of which are looking at 21 centimeter and one CMB experiment. We've got some others that I'm not going to have time to talk today about, but you can come ask me after the fact if you've got questions on some of those. Before I start, I do want to put an advertisement. We are trying to make this a regular thing, a conference every second year called Cosmology on Safari. We will be having it in late January, early February next year. It's much warmer in South Africa than Canada that time of year. And these are some PR shots. These were all taken by Cynthia Chang during one weekend when we were investigating sites. So, you know, this is what to expect. You may not get lions every day, but the rest of it is all really easy to see. Another thing that might happen is Norm Murray's talk was interrupted by a forest cobra that one of the guys brought in. So that is not a occurrence at most conferences. So do come down. This will be the website, and we'll update that when we've got the 2017 venue finalized, which, as I said, should be just a couple of weeks. The first experiment I'm going to talk about is called the Hydrogen Intensity and Real-Time Analysis Experiment. And this is what we hope it ends up looking like. It's collaboration amongst many people. And it's looking at the hydrogen 21 centimeter transition. So you're probably all familiar with this, but one thing I want to point out is that this is a forbidden transition. And that means if I just leave a hydrogen atom in an excited state, it takes about 10 million years to decay. So that's not the sort of decay time we're looking to. And that lets some things happen that don't happen for most transitions. And we can use this to do things like trace out baryonic acoustic oscillations. And then, you know, the one point I want to make about these, which I'm sure everybody's all familiar with, but the BAOs are very large. So if you're trying to find a number of modes, there's only about 100 BAO volumes in the entire universe within redshift 0.1. So if you want to do this statistically, you really need to go to high redshift and cover large volumes. Otherwise, you just don't have the modes to do things. So individual galaxies are really faint in neutral hydrogen, especially at high redshift, where high is like one. So if you want to do this, either you build an SKA, which is not cheap, but can't see the individual galaxies, or you do what's called intensity mapping. Because I don't care about any individual galaxy, right? I care about stacks of thousands or tens of thousands. There are about 10 to the 5 L-star galaxies per BAO volume. If I take a low-resolution map, make a low-resolution map, that effectively stacks up all the signals from these 10 to the 5 galaxies, and I can get away with a much less sensitive instrument than I need if I want to image them individually. And this sort of stacking technique is called intensity mapping, and the first detection was made actually by, they were mostly Canadian at the time, Tsu-Ching Cheng was the first author, Wei-Li Pan, using data from Green Bank Telescope, and cross-correlating with optical surveys, because you know the galaxies and the neutral hydrogen should be tracing at the same dark matter field. And it's a lot easier to measure these things in cross-correlation than autocorrelation, because then you have to worry about your noise systematics, just the noise level. In Canada, Zed has had a very long and proud role at the forefront of intensity mapping. So this is actual physical hardware in the ground for CHIME, the Canadian H1 mapping experiment, which I'm not part of, but have been enjoying watching their progress from afar. So they should be starting real data taking soon-ish. But we'd like to do something similar in the southern hemisphere. Dark energy is the nominal science goal, but you get a lot of cosmology. You measure 500,000 modes. As Francois will tell you, you will learn some things about the universe. And if you want to do this sort of, if you want to be sensitive to dark energy, this sort of sets what you want. You don't want to go to too high redshift because there are no dark energy effects, but you don't want to go too low because otherwise there's no volume. And you also want to have a fairly sensitive to large scales on the sky. You want fairly low resolution because the BAO ripples are just big. And so if you're not going to go the cylinder route, this sort of sets your natural disk design, which is a lot of dishes that are fairly small. So 6 meters certainly sounds like a small number. Yeah.
So
Well, okay, that is true. If you have models that you want us to test with effects at higher redshift, do come talk to us. We're looking. We will have data.
I find that if you already know what document it is, then it's no point.
That is a very fair point. And one of the things that's realized, radio telescopes these days are almost becoming computers. The front end part usually is you know not the dominant cost driver, and the back end, the computer, the digital part, actually we can more or less use the same stuff that's been developed for Chime, which is great. And I just want to say that we are supported by the university and by the South African NRF as part of the institutional engagement and partnership development. And so a higher axis, you may wonder why I call it that. So with a Y, that's those little fuzzy, cute critters up there. They're about this big. They're kind of lazy and very dorky. Their closest relatives are manatees and elephants. So they look like rodents, but actually if you look at their feet, they're really clearly different. So, you know, misspelling your acronym is also important, so you can Google it. So we only have to compete with a thrash metal band for the HI version. I'm pleased to say that they actually found us on Facebook and gave us a like for some of our hardware construction. So I've never been liked by a metal band before. It made me feel cool. So yeah, that's just the design plan. You need about 1,000 dishes to do this, operating between 400 and 800 megahertz. And so both Matt Dobbs and Keith Vanderland are part of the collaboration, and the hardware development that's been a great success for Chime just carries on over on the back end. So one thing that is different about the dishes is we don't see the full sky every day. We see a strip. But you want to go deep. So what you can do, and this saves a lot of money, is instead of having fancy tracking motorized dishes, you just leave them pointed. And you come back every 3 months and tilt them over in one direction. And then you leave them pointed again. And if you decided your telescope's not as sensitive as it should have been, you can leave them for 6 months instead of three. You'll go until you're bored. And so it's nice to have that as a runtime decision. With this, you know, one thing that's sort of nice and not nice about cylinders is you don't have the freedom. You are going to see the whole sky every day. And if you decided you wanted to concentrate your sensitivity, you can't do that anymore. And then we'll also we'll do some other things. You know, this also will make a great pulsar instrument, so we'll send some beams out for extra processing for pulsars. And I'll talk a fair bit about fast radio bursts in a minute. So with an instrument like this, as I said, you're measuring a lot of modes. All modes are not created equal. You know, if you're looking to study dark energy at a redshift where Niesh would agree that there are no dark energy effects, you know, adding more modes there probably isn't going to increase your knowledge. So with these BAO modes, the nominal survey sort of decreases error bars by about a factor of two over Planck. And I just want to say these forecasts are carried by Amadeus Weitzman and Mario Santos. And as I said, we've got this runtime freedom where we can decide to go wide or deep. And that's that curve in the bottom. If we go really wide sky, we get low error bars. That's a solid line. We get low error bars on large scales, low K, but worse error bars on high K because we're noise dominated there. But we can also instead decide to go strip on a deep strip. We have less sky area, so the low K modes are noisier just because of number of things. But we do better at high K. So depending on what the field looks like, we can decide really as we're operating what we want to do. A thing that I think we still need to think more about, and I would be interested in hearing what other people, you know, I want you to start thinking about this, is that between Chime and Hyrax, we'll have a spectroscopic low-resolution survey of the universe over a significant fraction of the volume. And so if you've got populations of things whose redshifts you don't know, you can now do statistical cross-correlations to get redshift distributions. So I think for things like LSST, this may be very powerful, but I think people should... Love to have all of you thinking more about what you could do with this. A little bit of a hardware update. So this was Jeff Peterson at Carnegie Mellon came out to try and convince us this would be an easy project to do. So he came out with a suitcase of electronics. We went down, have some friends at the Durban University of Technology that they're actually communications engineers, but they got into radio astronomy because there are fewer regulations about receiving than transmitting. They didn't even know that SKA was happening. But they've got a great lab, had some dishes. So over the course of 24 hours, we unpacked Jeff's suitcase, borrowed an FPGA board from SKA, and set up dishes and got fringes off the sun in 24 hours. And this was the first interferometer working in the province. So that was exciting. Now, these are little dishes. Here's our first prototype 6-meter dish. It unfortunately is no longer with us due to wind accident, but these are pretty cheap. These are order $1,000 dishes. So it's one of the nice things about commodity stuff. 6 meters is actually pretty big. We've installed some stuff at Hart-Rau, which is about an hour outside of Johannesburg. It was actually started for the Apollo missions because NASA wanted a ground station. But it's still operating. It's great. They've got a crane, which if you ever want to build stuff, I highly recommend make friends with somebody with a crane. In the right picture, this is our electronics cabin. So there's one GPU node in there and one FPGA board from Matt Dobbs. That one control room has about the same processing power as the entire VLA correlator before JVLA. And it's, you know, sort of several $1,000 cost. So, you know, Moore's Law just made a huge difference here. And so we turned this on. We had about a day or two of debugging. But more or less right away, we got this, which if you're a radio astronomer for your first day is really exciting. So the ripples on the right, that is, I think that's Centaurus A passing through the beam. And we weren't actually sure. We just turned it on and took data and saw this. All those vertical stripes, that's why we don't like people. That's radio frequency interference, and that's why radio astronomers try and get as far away from humans as you possibly can. So as you can imagine, if you were trying to measure remove foregrounds at a part in 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 in the presence of all that crud, you're going to have a bad day.
Did you just say that
we're humans. We're just misanthropes. We want you to go away. Or go sit downtown in your cities and just don't go into the countryside and maybe we can work. So I think this has come up a little bit already, but I want to say some more about it because especially it sounds like there's some misconceptions. Fast radio bursts. So Hyrax will be a fantastic fast radio burst machine. If it comes to Euclidean, just your rule of thumb is that your event rate is proportional to the dish diameter times the number of beams. Full Hyrax should have something like 500 times the Parkes event rate. So that means we should see as many bursts in a day as Parkes sees in a year and a half. So this will be a real game changer. So what are these things? Well, that's a really good question, and we would love to someday be able to tell you. The first one was found still only about 10 years ago. So it was an archival search of Parkes data, and Duncan Lorimer went back through and looked at this data and found this thing. So the burst itself lasted for about a millisecond, but because of dispersion along the line of sight, electrons delay low frequencies more than high frequencies, and this effect just happens to be sort of order second at typical frequencies that you observe at. So even though the burst lasts only a millisecond, it got smeared out by a second. You can undo this because it's a coherent smearing. It doesn't actually physically broaden the pulse. But if you want to look for some of these, you've basically got to look for all possible delays that are a millisecond long over seconds. One thing I also want to point out is that the pulsar people talk about dispersion measure, which not a unit I was used to as a cosmologist. So the dispersion measure is just the electron column density. So I'm going to encourage everybody to think about this in terms of tau, which we're all used to thinking about. So if you just take the dm, divide by 500,000, you've got your optical depth. So you can right away say, right, the dispersion measure through a massive cluster that has a tau of 0.01 should be order 5,000. So even if bursts are not very far, but extragalactic, we should still expect to see some at very high dispersion measures if they happen to be sitting behind coma, say. There's still not very many known. The event rate is going up, but we're still sitting on about 20 total FRBs. So why do we think these things are not just something random? Maybe giant pulses from pulsars, and this is one of the reasons. They really just look different. They're a different population. So I've split, I've plotted now all known FRBs and all known pulsars, and I've split between plus or minus 3 degrees in galactic latitude and things above. So the left plot is the high latitude, where again, high is above 3. And you can see in the vertical axis is the dispersion measure, the column density. And you can see that these bursts are sitting way above anything you see in the Milky Way. And the thing on the right is the low. There's been one found at, that would be helpful. Yes, thank you. Which is the this button? Top one. Okay. Yeah. So this guy over here. When I spoke to one of the speakers yesterday, he said that everybody thinks a fast radio burst repeats. This is the only burst that has been seen to repeat. None of these have been seen to repeat, and this guy is sitting right in the galactic plane. So the argument that this is a fast radio burst is that this dispersion measure is too high by a factor of 2. But that is the thread that argument is lying on. So I got into this a little while ago, trying to figure out basically getting it for Hyrax, because the things that people have been doing to search for these were just not going to scale to 1,000 beams. You would just drown or take half a megawatt of power to do the search. So I came up with some repackaging of 45-year-old algorithms from Joe Taylor that had sort of fallen out of favor, but doing a transform that runs in data times log 2 of the number of channels, which is very fast. And then Kendrick has been going off and going crazy with this, expanding it so you can find any sort of crazy burst you might ever find without losing any signal to noise in real time. Now, new algorithms are all great, but I don't believe them until I've tested on real data. So fortunately, the follow-up intensity mapping efforts at GBT had a bunch of archival data, sort of 650 hours that were perfect for going back and searching for fast radio bursts. So to try and test this out, this was really just a code verification exercise as far as I was concerned. We ran through a bunch of data, and it was sitting between 700 and 900 megahertz, which is also great because there had been no fast radio bursts ever detected outside of 1.4 gigahertz. We're saying Chime, Hyrax, we're going to discover tons and tons of bursts, but nobody had ever seen one of these frequencies. So it'd be nice to find something. So fortunately, this was a real unexpected surprise for me. Whaley had more faith, because that's Whaley for those who know him. But we found what looks like this is sort of almost what you'd expect from a textbook. This ended up being a 40 sigma event sitting in the GPT data. And it's great. First detection. Here's the plot. This is the way the Pulsar guys like to see it, where you can see this beautiful. So this delay should go as lambda squared. And you can just see this track. The burst lasted for about 2 milliseconds, the arrival was spread out over 2 seconds. So this is the first seen by GBT. People were a little bit nervous that maybe something funny was at Parkes, especially because for those of you who've been paying attention, there was a second class of very similar events at Parkes that was tracked to a microwave oven. This did not come from the Parkes microwave oven, I'm glad to say. And this is the first one seen in the Chime and Hyrax band, so there will be things out there for us to see. This was also the first burst seen with linear polarization, which meant we could get a Faraday rotation measure. And one of the things we can say from that is the Faraday rotation is higher than you expect from either a cosmological line of sight, because you get cancellation from the fact that the electric field, the magnetic field is expected to be pointed both towards you and away from you as you integrate. And is about a factor of, 10 or 20 higher than you expect from the Milky Way. So there's probably, with this Faraday rotation measure, there's probably something sitting in the environment of the FRB. The scattering and dispersion, this number right here, you expect minus 2 for a cold, not dense plasma. We measure the delay, the slope of that index for the dispersion to be minus 1.998 plus or minus 0.003. So it's just exactly the value you would have expected. And we are sensitive to a much broader range than this, so it didn't have to come out this close. Mm-hmm. It depends on the electron distribution. So what you're getting is the magnetic field times electron distribution, which is, it depends on where the dispersion measure is coming from. So I'll show you in a minute why I think that's probably not a big concern. So any electrons you have, if you had any electrons near a pulsar, it would be big. Yeah, but that's not necessarily, so that's useful for saying that it's not from the line of sight. So the mean magnetic field was about half a microgauss. Yeah, I think 0.4, something like that. But remember, that's the integral of the, so that's the integral of the electron density times the line of sight field. So another thing that we detected is scattering. This is another reason we think that, there's a bunch of electrons near the near our burst. And that is because if you have multipath scattering, then low frequencies get spread out more than high frequencies. This is not, you know, dispersion you can undo, scattering you can't. And so we do see this. We see that the low frequency, the pulse is broader than the high frequency. We also see scintillation. And this is sort of small angle twinkling of stars. And this is well known. So this scintillation we think is coming from inside the Milky Way because it looks very much like a nearby along the line of sight pulsar in the Milky Way. And you can say that because of scattering, you know, this stars twinkle and planets don't. So because the pulsar is twinkling, that means that the size is unresolved by the Milky Way scattering screen, which makes the angular size very small of the burst. But you know there must be some physical size because there's scattering here. So this scattering means that the burst has to be a ways away because it has to be unresolved by the time it gets into the Milky Way. And then another thing that'll maybe help answer more of your question is the dispersion law is not actually nu to the minus 2 lambda squared. It's k squared is omega squared plus omega plasma squared. And so as you get close to the plasma frequency, then you actually start to deviate from this. And the fact that we measure basically exactly what you would have expected helps you put an upper limit on the plasma frequency. And in turn, if you say, right, all the dispersion is coming from near the burst, this upper limit on the plasma frequency puts a lower puts an upper limit on the density. And given a finite column density, that puts a lower limit on the size of whatever region is going on. And that lower limit is about 10 AUs. So if we try and put everything as close as we can to the burst, we can't get it closer than 10 AUs without violating this. So that means it's, you know, the dispersion isn't coming from right near a compact object, or this would break down. And you know, these arguments all put this thing extragalactic, which is really nice because it was not clear before this. You know, they could have been a very local population that had were embedded in dense plasma. So what do we know now? Well, I think they're very clearly not Milky Way pulsars, right? They're just the dispersion latitude relation is just wrong. Do they repeat? Well, we don't really know. The only one that's been repeating, found to repeat so far, is sitting in the plane. It's got a factor of 2-ish higher dispersion than you'd expect, but maybe it's sitting in something. It's at a galactic latitude of 0.25. There have been 20 seen, and so you have to take this number with a grain of salt because there's a big factor of where have you actually been looking for a burst to. But if you just take the naive things, you'd only expect about 0.1 burst out of the 20 seen for an isotropically sensitive survey to be within a quarter of a degree of the plane. So this might be a classic FRB. I'm not saying it's not, but I would not be surprised if this were different from the ones from the rest of the ones that we've seen. I do think they're extragalactic. One thing that's very interesting is that many of the Parkes bursts, which have seen most of them so far, to the limits of their instrument, they show no scattering, and they've seen several, or at least a few, with linear polarization, and these guys show exactly the Faraday rotation you'd expect from the Milky Way. So there may be multiple populations, and some of these guys that have been seen by Parkes may be actually really clean cosmological distance. No or very small local dispersion. And if that's the case, then there's lots of cool things that you can do. We're still hurting, though, from the fact that we don't have a redshift. So there was excitement a few months ago where somebody thought they had a redshift. That turned out to be just wrong. What happened is they'd gone and looked in an error box after a burst and seen a decaying radio source and said, aha, this must be it. They went up and got a spectrum and said, right, there's our redshift. But there are a lot of variable radio sources in the sky, and people kept watching that, and like right after they published, it got brighter again. So we don't have a redshift. And so this will, once we get this, then we'll really be able to say whether or not these things are useful. But the field is really going to change shortly. So within not very long, we're going to be finding, instead of 20 total, we're going to be finding dozens per day. And if these things are cosmological and we can get a handle on any contribution from local, or if we can find a gold sample that doesn't have local contamination, then you can do things like start to break some of these degeneracies in cosmology. So things like the KSE, you get the electron density times the velocity. The electron column density times the velocity. Things like the thermal synchronization of it, you get the temperature times the electron column density. And now, those are big degeneracies, but now you might be able to measure the electron column density directly with these FRBs. So the measurement on that is accurate to, you know, part in a thousand, typically. I mean, it's just nailed. So the real uncertainty there will actually be cosmological, because you don't know the clumpiness along the line of sight. So think about these sorts of things. Because this data will be coming, and I think not many people have spent a lot of time, not many cosmologists have spent a lot of time thinking about what you might actually be able to do with it. And I think it's more than has been appreciated. You can test the equivalence principle. So you've got a sharp impulse that you see, you know, maybe halfway across the universe, and you know that the arrival time of high and low energy photons in the band is the same. If you just eat the whole dispersion, that's the same to a part in 10 to the 17. If your favorite test you want to run doesn't look like lambda squared for the delay, then it's a part in 10 to the 20 for the arrival time. So there's things there. I don't know if this will work out or not, but you know, before long we'll have order 1% of the sky measured. And so if LIGO gets into the hundreds of events range, some of these will go off inside the beam of somebody that can see an FRB. So if neutron star mergers put out a millisecond burst, this is now a good way that you can get a redshift, you know, unambiguous redshift in position at the arc second level, which would be, I think, of interest to a few people in the community. So one of the things we'd like to do, we haven't actually proposed yet, but if we can put little clumps of antennas for not very much money around, and do VLBI offline. And with the dishes, this is easy to do. This is sort of a few hundred thousand dollar experiment. And we could, with that, maybe get redshifts and milli-arc second position for every fast radio burst seen by HIRAX. So if there are gravitational wave counterparts, this could be potentially interesting. So the current HIRAX status is So we've got approval from the NRF, we've got money to start, we need to work on a side agreement with SKA. We do have enough money to build 128 elements, which already would, I think, be a significant increase over Parkes and the FRB rate, a powerful instrument in of itself. We're just about done with this 8-element thing. For correlation, we're heavily dependent on Moore's law, but the GPUs are coming out now that are sort of the right ones that we can use for not a crazy power budget. But of course, Moore's law is always nice. And again, I'm serious. If you've got other things you can think about doing or you'd like to do, you should come talk to us, because we're very open to new science. Okay. I'm going to change. How much longer am I supposed to talk? 20 minutes. Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk now about change gears entirely and talk about global epoch of reionization experiment that we're working on. So early in the universe, hydrogen was coupled to the CMB, but as UDF expands, things that, gases, the temperature goes as a to the minus 5/3, whereas the photons go as a to the minus 4/3. So gas cools faster than photons. And because the hydrogen transition is forbidden, that means that the hydrogen gets decoupled from the CMB temperature. And so as the universe expands, the hydrogen cools, and you can see hydrogen in absorption against the CMB. And eventually, Lyman alpha photons turn on and excite the hydrogen atoms, and so you get dip, and then the temperature comes back up, and then goes away. And the frequency which has happened tells you the redshift of these things, and the shape tells you tells you something about the sources that are doing the initial lighting up of the universe, right? So this is not ionization. So this effect ends when reionization really gets going. This is telling you about cosmic dawn. So a few different people are working on this. This is Edge's experiment. You can see these things are pretty small. That's a van for scale in the background. This is one. This is called SciHi. So this was built by Jeff Peterson and Tabitha Wojtek as her thesis experiment, who's now brought it out to South Africa. So why would she come to South Africa? Well, here is what data look like from SciHi, both in Guadalupe. So they, for her thesis, she took it 200 kilometers off the coast of Mexico. And what do you see 200 kilometers off the coast of Mexico? Well, you see radio stations. You know, 200 kilometers is nowhere near far enough. We also took a practice run to the Karoo. These bumps were internally generated RFI, so that got fixed. So you can see that looks nice down here. But still, there's radio stations. So, you know, you have to be further away than a few hundred kilometers from people. So I actually discovered this by reading the South African Airways In-Flight magazine, where they're bragging about their new science base to look at albatrosses and seals. But I saw, you know, something. Now, this little speck right here, it's called Marion Island, that's 2,000 kilometers away from the nearest people. And I said, I know something besides birding you can do on this island. So we put in a proposal. I don't know if Vera's here. Hi. This is the island size. Here's 2.5 kilometers for you. So you can sort of figure out how big your dipole array is going to have to be. And maybe where you could put it. Here's some models. So this is you get randomization population 2 stars, and this is population 3. And the effect is actually pretty big. You know, it's tens of millikelvin. So you don't actually need a lot of integration time. You just need clean data. So we were fortunate. Most half-assed proposal I've ever put in, but mostly because I just couldn't get information from the birders. They're not used to talking to astronomers. But it went through anyways. That's one of the great things about South Africa. And so we sent it down just a couple months ago to go sit over here and try and observe. One thing I want to give a shout out to Berkeley for is these snap boards. So they're designed for HERA, the HERA digitization, but they work perfectly for us. So this whole box is the entire digital back end of our experiment. It's Fourier transforming somewhere between 4 and 8 billion numbers per second. And the whole thing, this board plus the electronic front end plus a couple of Raspberry Pis draws about 30 watts. So you can take your whole experiment and run it off a couple of car batteries for a day or two, which is really pretty cool. So we're very proud of this. The original version was used in a computer, and they had to swap batteries every couple hours. So off it went. Now you may notice that they're way away from the coast here, and that's because seals are curious critters and will come up and visit you if you don't put it up. But fortunately, the seal stayed away. Due to logistical challenges, we only got a few days of data. The birders also not used to like time-critical observation data, but we did get some good data. And so we, in our original proposal, had said we want to leave something over winter next year. So I think we should be fine to leave this going for the full year. And one of the nice things also is that the ionosphere is better in the winter. So leaving something over the winter, I think, will lead to much better data. But we have enough to already be very excited. So this is a very rough calibration. These ripples will make go away. But this is some of the cleanest data ever taken. So here's the spectrum from real data. And you can see that there's no RFI visible, right? So we like this. This is why we hate people. And you can see over here, this is now the zoom in on the FM band. So these little divots are instrumental. We'll get those calibrated out. We've only had the data for a few weeks. But you can see, you know, in comparison, you know, all these spikes from FM, even from 200 kilometers away, right, they're just gone now. So that's super exciting. So stay tuned for this. We clearly want more data, but you know, the sensitivity wise in principle should be enough. A day is enough for this measurement if you get the right day, the golden magic day. Yep. It's complicated. I don't think there's like regular radar stations. They have a bunch of high-powered radar for ionospheric work. So they're blasting, you know, tens of megahertz stuff all over the continent. Yeah. Jeff has gone down and looked there, and he says that South Pole is one of the worst RFI environments he's ever seen. So, we've thought about this. One of the nice things about Marion, right, the weather's crappy. It's in the middle of the ocean. It's in the roaring 40s, so it's always windy and always cold, but never that cold. It stays right around freezing. Running something off of batteries in the Antarctic. Also, a thing you don't necessarily think about, solar power in the Antarctic. There's no sun, so you can't do that. I think we're happy with Marion for now. And also, for the ionosphere, it actually gets a little bit worse as you go closer to the pole, and that's because Most of the ionosphere comes from photodissociation from the sun, but you do get some from the auroras also. And that all gets funneled to the magnetic poles. And so if you look at the maps, unfortunately, I think I'm a little bit nervous. As of last week, I think the company that does this has maybe gone belly up, their web server's gone. But if you look at the maps, you see that sort of Marian latitudes during the winter is about as good as the ionosphere ever gets. So we're excited about that. And so this is looking for the global power, the global average signal. But I just want to say, I don't have time to really talk about it, but we're also part of HERA. I mostly want to show off that this is actual physical hardware in the ground now. So HERA is coming along nicely. And that will observe not the mean signal, but now the fluctuations from sources that are actually causing the reheating in the ionization. There are 19 dishes going now. So this is the artist's conception of the final ray. So with that, actually, any questions on the 21 centimeter part? Or should I tell you about ACT now, which you may already know all about? We still have some good shots. Okay. So another thing that we've been heavily involved with is ACT, which has come up several times already, which is, just to remind you, there's a 6-meter telescope in Chile looking at the microwave background. And why would you build a 6-meter telescope in Chile? I think Francois put up the COBE to WMAP to Planck resolution. So we'll start off with Planck, and then if you go to ACT, you can see that there's still quite a bit more resolution to have. And so particularly, look at these things like point sources, right? We can see these in a way that's, they're just, from beam dilution, they're just gone in Planck. They only see the brightest ones. And also, this little speck right there, I didn't actually check, I was just looking this morning, but I'm pretty sure that's a galaxy cluster, because that's what they look like in SC. And you can't see it in Planck. So resolution really is useful for both getting to higher L and for seeing things and having a better idea of what your, what your small scale astrophysical contaminants might look like. One thing that's also very nice about ACT's location in Chile is that this is a map of various large scale structure surveys, and the CMB cross, the large scale structure, the galaxy surveys we found very powerful. And this is the region visible from Chile. So it overlaps all of the LSST survey area and a bunch of other things. So that's been very incredibly valuable. So now that I've started to build hardware, I have to show some hardware shots. These are ACT cameras through the years. Advanced ACT is the next generation. I'm proud to say, I didn't do anything, so I can be very proud of it. The first camera for Advanced ACT has just shipped down to Chile and is getting installed now. Here's the ACT pull receiver, so that's the thing that's currently on. And one thing I want to point out is this, we have three tubes, so there are three independent cameras, and we can replace them, upgrade them independently. This one right here is the first dichroic camera installed on an instrument. So this observes both at 90 and 150 gigahertz simultaneously, which is great, because that's twice the data. And this actually works, which is really exciting. So this is Centaurus A at 90 and at 150 with our dichroic array. And you can see that, again, if you want to see things, resolution is really useful. You can see Centaurus A break up here, whereas it's unresolved at Planck. But on large scales, the agreement is very good. And the detector noises are good. And so also, if you want to think about, this is a useful number to think about as you think about space versus ground-based, is how many ground detectors is worth one space detector. So our noises in good weather are getting down to about 207, 280 micro K root seconds per detector, which is a fantastic number. This is about as good as ever been done from the ground. But even at that, Planck's, I think, are 60 or so. You can say that. So in good weather, it still takes about 25 ground-based detectors to be worth one Planck detector. That's why Planck does fantastically with 70 detectors, and we need thousands. And then, of course, if the weather gets worse, your sensitivity rapidly falls off. This is also why we put things in Chile in the South Pole. Pardon? At these frequencies. Pardon? Yeah, 200 is a lot worse on the ground, and 280 is even worse than that. We've put first data release out last year, 2 years ago. So this was based on four deep patches. Each were about sort of 60 to 70 square degrees. The noise was in the 11 or 12 micro-K arc minutes in TT. And this was with 150 gigahertz array, and actually that had very low yield. So this is sort of really bad sensitivity. Less than half the detectors worked in this array. But nevertheless, we can still see, we're pretty strongly sample limited. This is the E map, and that's the B map from one of our deeps. And you can see that, right, there's just way more power in E, which is what you'd hope to see. So here's the spectrum from that. This is the state as of last year with Planck and some SBT results and ACT. We've been able to do some neat things. So this is now looking at cluster lensing by stacking on clusters. We can, this is Matacharoval et al. You can measure the lensing signal from stacked halos if you know where they are. This is one of the reasons why it's really valuable to have optical data, is you can go off and find these halos optically and then stack and study them that way. There have been other things out from that too, but we've got a lot more data now. So we're busy trying to get the 2014 results out, and we hope to have those out soon. That's why we haven't done 2015 yet. So that will mostly be this patch right here. We call it Deep 5-6, and this is about, I think this is 12% of the actual data that we're trying to get now, but we can show some preliminary results from that. And here's with the new data from that field, what the spectrum looks like. So our noise is a significant improvement in noise and in sky area. So the E mode spectrum has gotten a lot better. The T mode still looks great. Everything seems to be behaving on the T mode front. so stay tuned for that. A couple of early things that we can say is, I think you've all seen this plot about four times or so far, the lensing. These points will come out shortly. You can ask Alex about these if you want to know anything. So this is at 500, so that's sitting out here. So this is actually still a fairly noticeable improvement in the data. These aren't just sort of random roundup errors. Ask Alex about all your detailed questions, because he's done this. I can't take credit for this. I can take credit for that. I spend a lot of my life making these maps and making them not systematics dominated, which I believe some people in the audience might tell you is rather important. But Alex gets to field all the lensing questions. another thing that ACT was the first to do that's been sort of neat, and again, this just shows the power of having optical surveys, is the first real detection of KSC, kinetic Snyder Zeldovich effect. And the reason that's hard to see is there's no spectral signature, so it looks just like CMB fluctuations. It's positive if things are moving towards you, negative if things are moving away from you. So there's no sort of like three-point moment like there is for the thermal that you could expect. But if you have halos of galaxies, you know that gravity works, well, we think. If I've got two nearby halos, they should be falling towards each other. So if I take pairs of halos from optical surveys, I can predict an SE signal and the sign, because I know that this guy should be blue shifted and this guy should be red shifted. So if you go off and stack on that, then you see this. This is more or less what you expect. These points are about 50% correlated. We'll get that sorted out shortly. So look soon for DeBernardis et al. That'll have these results written up. This is stacking from data release 11, turn to the 11 solar mass galaxies in bigger. I don't actually know, because I haven't, with the correlation, you have to be a little careful. But it's. I think the initial detection was about 3 sigma, and this is a significant improvement on that. Just wait for the paper. It won't be long. The near future, as I said, we've got, NSF is funded for an upgrade over ACTPOL. A thing to look in this plot is these little crazy spinning things here. These are half wave plates. And so they're modulating the polarization. And that helps you get to larger angular scales. So it's a little scary to have like giant rotating things in your focal plane. Also stay tuned for this, because in principle this should let us, not be noise limited L's of several hundred, but L's of, an order of magnitude or lower, better, which is great if you want to do If you don't want to have to wait for the next satellite mission, things like this are really important. And the other thing is that the frequency coverage for advanced ACT is going to be significantly widened. So we're going to have some low frequency for synchrotron removal, and each array will be dichroics, and then 90, 150s, I guess we're calling it 230, so 2 to 20, 230. For the foreseeable future, this 350 gigahertz band from Planck is still going to be incredibly important. It's really hard to do these frequencies from the ground because of the atmosphere. So this remains, for decades, a huge contribution of Planck. So we're really glad that they did that. The future for this is starting now. So I said the first camera is getting installed as we speak. We'll go to much bigger areas, tens of thousands of square degrees with advanced ACT. So, these are our planned survey areas, matching up with DESI and DES. And the error should be great. I think we've seen some already. Peter put some up. But the neutrino and effective constraint is going to get, really good. So we should be able to definitely say normal versus an inverted hierarchy. I think that sigma is about 0.05 and effective. So if you've got N effectives floating around, the pressure is going to go up. The dark energy combined with lensing, I'm not sure I'm ready yet to believe the SC cluster contribution to this. Whatever it is, we'll do very well. A large increase over the Dark Energy Task Force figure of merit. And finally, last slide is we have joined forces. $45 million checks will encourage the joining of forces. For the Simons Observatory, which will sort of do a lot of the groundwork laying for S4. This will pay for new receivers, which is really where most of the development is. Building 6 or 10 meter telescopes is not free, but it's not that hard to do. Building new receivers that are photon limited with multiple frequencies and no systematics is a challenge. So this will go a long ways to helping that. So thanks again for having me. And if you've got any of the other experiments that I flashed up, I'd like to talk more about, come find me during lunch. So thanks very much.
Questions for John? Am I supposed to ask all the questions? Or okay, I guess everybody's hungry.
I'm fine with lunch.
You're fine with lunch? Okay, so let's head to lunch then, and we meet back here at 3 then.